Bibles out and turn them to Acts chapter 22. We're discussing in our lesson this evening the conclusion of our story of Paul's journey to Rome and how his journey to Rome is an act of the providence of God and how the plans that God had made for Paul to reach the Gentiles would be furthered by his being able to be in Rome. In Acts, the 22nd chapter, we notice that Paul is giving his defense before the mob. And as he begins to recount his conversion, as we finished off this morning, he told them that he was sent as a vessel to go into the Gentile. And when he said that word in verse number 22, they stopped their ears, they quit listening, and they determined that he was not fit to live. And so there became another angry scene. And then he's taken back to the barracks in chapter number 22, beginning in verse number 24. And the commander ordered him back and brought him to the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging so that he might know why they shouted so against him. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by him, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?" And when the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, "Take care of what you do, for this man is a Roman." Then the commander came and said, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" He said, "Yes." And the commander answered and said, "With a large sum I obtained this citizenship." And Paul said, "But I was born a citizen." Now, according to Roman law, you could not be scourged, you could not be put into prison unless you had a trial and you were condemned and found guilty. Paul had no trial, he had not been condemned, and he was about to be taken out and scourged, and so he called upon his Roman citizenship. It is true that he is a Jew. We know that from Galatians chapter 3. But it is also true that he is a Roman citizen by birth. And so he calls upon his Roman citizenship in order that the commander might consider what he's about to do. And if you continue reading, you'll find that the commander released him from his bonds, being greatly afraid. And it says in verse number 30, "And the next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priest and the council to appear, and they brought Paul down to set them before him." And so now the stage is set for the Sanhedrin and the chief priest and the elders to come before, for Paul to come before the council, that all the charges that were brought against him might be ascertained and that they might be able to testify concerning his conduct and why they were wanting to kill him. Now, in Acts chapter 23, Paul stands before the council. Now, I want you to know that Paul knows this council. He understands how they work. He understands how they operate. And he is in no fear of standing before that religious Jewish hierarchy. Now, as he comes before the council and the chief priest, I want you to notice in verse number 1. In verse number 1, Paul spoke before the council with a pure conscience. He says that Paul, looking earnestly at the council, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." In other words, everything that Paul had done in his life, he did it in good conscience. He did it because he thought it was the right thing to do. That means when he was Saul of Tarsus, when he was persecuting the church, when he was binding men and women and putting them in prison, giving his voice against them, he did all of that with a clear and good conscience because he thought that that was the will of God in his life. But when he found out he was wrong, he changed. Now, his statement that he lived in all good conscience came with a swift reply. In verse number 2, "And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him and said, 'Strike him on the mouth.' Then Paul said to him, 'God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, for you set to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?' And they who stood by said, 'Do you not revile God's high priest?' Then Paul said, 'I did not know, brethren, that he was high priest For it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. And so we see that Paul is struck and he's rebuked because they believe that he's been disrespectful to the high priest. Now, what do you do when you're before a group of people who are going to judge your faith? Paul uses some wisdom. And he does something that is very wise. Look at verse number 6. Paul perceives and knows that the council is divided. What do you mean that the council is divided? That means there are Pharisees and there are Sadducees. The Pharisees are the legalistic sect. The Sadducees are those who do not believe in the resurrection nor angels. And so when he addresses them, here's what he says. But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other were Pharisees, he cried out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, concerning the hope and the resurrection of the dead, and now I'm being judged. And when he said this, a dissension rose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees said that there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit. But the Pharisees confessed both. And there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes and the Pharisees' party rose and protested, saying, we find no evil in the man. But if a spirit or angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. You see, the Pharisees were content to let him go. If he was a Pharisee, he was one of them. He was one of their own, and they weren't going to oppose one of their own. And so they were willing to let him go, but not the Sadducees, for they did not believe in the resurrection or the Spirit. And so there began to be a mob within the council. And in verse number 10, it says, and now there arose a great dissension, and the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. And so once again, Paul is taken by force away from the council, and they've done it to now to protect him. All of this is done to set up what happens in the next verse. In the next verse, we have a promise that God makes to Paul. Look at verse number 11. God's promise to Paul. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness of me in Rome. Now, one thing he left out. How is he going to get there? He is in prison in Jerusalem. The Jews are trying to kill him. He's in the barracks of a centurion who's trying to protect his life because the Jews are trying to kill him. The commander of the garrison is trying to find out why the uproar, what charges they brought against him, and he can't get any answers. And yet in all of this controversy and all this tumultuous emotion around him, God says, you're going to Rome. Now, Paul didn't question how. He didn't wonder how. He just knew that God said, you will be witness to me in Rome, and that was good enough for Paul. Now, the men who are out to kill Paul, they're ruthless. And so they got a plot. And in chapter 23, beginning in verse 12 through 15, they determine to make an oath, and 40 of them band together, and they decide to neither eat nor drink until they kill Paul. And so what they want is Paul to be brought back before the council that they might testify and question him there. But all of that is a ploy to get him on the road in order that they might kill him. Poor fellas, they died. Because they said they would neither eat nor drink until he was killed, and that didn't happen. But I want you to notice in this oath to taking care, something happened. Is this a coincidence? Is that what this is? Turn to chapter 23 and look at verse 16. When Paul's sister's son heard of their ambush, he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, "Take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him." Now, how is it that his nephew overhears of this plot? Would we say he was just in the right place at the right time? It was just a coincidence, was it? What did Paul promise Paul? "You will testify of me in Rome." And so he goes to the commander, and he tells him the tale. And notice in verse number 22, the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, "Tell no one that you have revealed these things to me." And so he's told to not tell anyone that he has told him of this plot. And so he determines to pass on his problem to Felix. In verse number 23, he called for two centurions, saying, "Prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night." That seems like a lot of men to just get one man to Caesarea, doesn't it? But he knew how ruthless these men were to kill Paul. And he provided mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. Now, when he's sent to Felix, there's a little problem. He doesn't have any charges against him. "Here's this man I've arrested. I put him in stocks. The Jews want to kill him, but I cannot ascertain of what he has done in order, so I have to send him, and maybe you can find out." And so now, in the middle of the night, he's taken, and he safely is brought to Felix. Now, as he is brought to Felix, then a series of events begin to take place. Now, these series of events lead to where Paul will ultimately be. Paul is tried before Felix. In chapter number 24, they bring their great orator, and they bring him down. His name is Tertullus. And he is going to give evidence to the governor against Paul. And so they brought out their big guns. And they're going to bring him and they're going to show that Paul is guilty. And they're going to get him condemned by Felix. But notice in verse number 3, "We accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Nevertheless, not to be tedious to you any further, I beg you to hear by your courtesy a few words from me." You know what? The Jews had no regard for Rome or for any of their officials unless it would help them do what they wanted done. They are dishonest. They are deceitful. They want to use Felix in order to get rid of Paul. They're not interested in Felix's judgment, his honesty, and his nobility. That is the farthest thing from their mind. All they want is for him to be condemned. Now, after they make charges, look at verse number 9. "And the Jews also assented, maintaining that these things were so." And so they made false charges. They couldn't be proven, but these accusations are made. And then Paul is given permission to speak for himself. Notice verse 15 and 16. "I have hope in God, which they themselves also accept, that there will be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. This being so, I myself always strive to have a good conscience without offense towards God and men." He says, "I'm not here for anything I did. I'm here because I said that there was going to be a resurrection. And because of that, that's why they brought me here." And so all Paul is doing is telling them the events that led up after his arrest. Now, in the meantime, there was no problem in the temple. What does that mean? Look at verse 18 and 19. "In the midst of which some Jews from Asia," notice he points out the Jews from Asia, "found me purified in the temple, neither with a mob nor with a tumult." What is he saying? He's saying, "I didn't cause this problem. I was minding my own business. I was in that temple, and these Jews from Asia came down, and they created the mob, and they created the tumult. They ought to have been here before you to object if they had anything against me." You see what Paul is saying? If I've done anything, Bring those Jews down and have them give testimony. Where are they? If I cause this mob, if I cause this scene, where are these Jews to testify against me? They're not there. I wonder why they're not there. And they weren't there when he stood before the garrison commander either. I wonder why they were absent conveniently. Because they knew that the charges were false. In verse number 20, what is the verdict? Or else let those who are themselves say, if they found any wrongdoing in me when I stood before the council. Unless it is for this one statement, I cried out, standing among them, saying, concerning the resurrection of the dead, I am being judged by you this day. You know what he's saying? He says, the council didn't find me guilty. Part of them wanted to let me go. The other part wanted to kill me. They still haven't proved their case. And you know what Felix should have done? He should have released him. That should have been the end of it. But that does not happen. Felix holds off his decision. Why? Look at verse 22. But when Felix heard these things, having more accurate knowledge of the way, he adjourned to the proceedings and said, when Lysias the commander comes down, I will make a decision on your case. So he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and let him have liberty, and told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for or visit him. You know what he is? He's kind of under house arrest. You know why? Because Felix knows that he's innocent. Felix knows it. How do I know that? Look at the text. He has accurate knowledge of the way. What does that mean, he has accurate knowledge of the way? He knows the dissension that's among the Jews. He's well aware of it. And he knows that that's the problem in this case with Paul. It has nothing to do with right or wrong. It has to do with their religion. That's why they're angry at Paul. He knows that. But he's going to wait. You know what he's doing? He's trying to appease them. You know why? To keep his job. What if he can't keep the peace? What if they have a mob before Felix? What's Rome going to do with Felix? I'll tell you what they'll do with him. They'll take him out and kill him and replace him. And so he's just going to play politics. And you think politics just came around in the 20th century. This is politics. He's going to try to keep his job. But a very interesting thing happens right after that. Felix and Drusilla. Look at verse number 24. And after some days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning faith in Christ. Now, here is Paul in prison. He's really trying to defend himself. And what does he do? He's not in misery. He's not having a self-pity party. You know what he's doing? He's trying to teach the gospel. And he taught it to Felix. Look at the next verse. Now, as he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and answered, go away for now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you. Sadly, there is no record in the biblical account that the convenient time ever came for Felix. But did he understand? The text says he reasoned about righteousness, judgment, and self-control, and he trembled. Yes, he understood, but he wasn't willing to be converted. Now, and so, Felix has a problem. He can't fix it, so let's just pass him off again. Now we'll send him to Festus. The Jews sought to bring Paul back to Jerusalem. But remember, those 40 men are getting hungry. They want him brought back so they can kill him. And so that's still not going to work. And so in chapter 25, in the first five verses, they beseech Festus to send him back to Jerusalem. Well, that doesn't happen. Why? Conveniently, look at verse 4. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself was going there shortly. Therefore, he said, let those who have authority among you go down with me and accuse this man to see if there's any fault with him. Now, isn't it convenient that Festus is going to Caesarea. Is that just convenience? Is that a coincidence that he's going to Caesarea? At this particular time, when Paul is in prison, when Paul is there with Felix, and Felix can't find any fault with him, is that just a coincidence? And then in verse 6, he's brought before the judgment seat. And when he remained there 10 days, and he went down to Caesarea, and the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, he commanded Paul to be brought to him. And so now he's before Festus, and he's before the judgment seat. And in verse 7 and 8, the charges cannot be proven. They make charge, they make countercharge, but there can be no agreement with their charge, and so there's no corroborating evidence, and so they're still without one charge of any sin or guilt in the man. And then Paul does something. Look at verse number 9. What does he do? But Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, answered Paul and said, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things?" Now you know Paul's not going to Jerusalem. Why isn't Paul going to Jerusalem? He knows about those 40 men. He knows they're waiting to kill him. Now, would you say Paul was afraid? No, Paul wasn't afraid. But he's thinking of the work that he has yet to do for Christ, and he's not going to cut it short. And so he's going to take some precautions. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's a lesson here. Just because God says that he will protect us and all things work together for good to them that love the Lord doesn't mean that he gave us a mind for nothing. Paul used his wisdom to benefit the cause of Christ. Look at verse 9. Verse 10 says, "So Paul said, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself very well know. For if I am an offender or have committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. But if there is nothing in these things which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar." Where is Caesar? In Rome. In Rome. Did Paul say he wasn't guilty? Yes. He says, if I'm guilty and I'm deserving of death, put me to death. But these men have found no fault in me, and you know I'm innocent. And therefore, I'm not going to let you deliver me into their hands to do what they want to do to me. I'm a Roman citizen. I appeal to Caesar. And when he appealed to Caesar, Paul is granted his request in verse 12. Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered and said, "You have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go." Now he's on his way to Rome. Now, ladies and gentlemen, did it just happen this way? Did it just work out this way? Did all these events just happen by circumstances? And did all these events just happen by coincidence that everything lines up, one thing after another, to push him closer and closer to Rome? Because remember, that's where God wants him to be. And the question you must ask yourself, why Rome? Because it's the gateway to Asia. That's why he wants him in Rome. He wants him there to spread the gospel. That's why he's going to be his witness. Now, before he can go to Rome, we've got to stand before one more person. Now, Festus tells Paul's case to Agrippa. And he's intrigued about Paul. He's heard about Paul. He's seen some of the miracles of Paul. And so he kind of wants to talk to Paul for himself. You know, like idle curiosity. I've heard about this man all my life. I want to meet him. And so he says, okay, I'll bring him down and you can have him stand before you. He came to visit Festus. And so in verse number 13 through 21, he determines that he will hear Paul's case. Now, look at verse 22. Therefore, having obtained help from God to this day, chapter 25, verse 22. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man to myself. Tomorrow, he said, you shall hear him. So tomorrow is determined that Agrippa will listen to Paul's case. Paul had done nothing worthy of death. Look at Festus' own words. Look at verse 24. King Agrippa and all the men who are here present with us, you see this man about whom the whole assembly of the Jews petitioned me, both at Jerusalem and here, crying out that he was not fit to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing, look at what he says. He has committed nothing deserving of death, and that he himself has appealed to Augustus, I decided to send him. I have nothing certain to write to my Lord concerning him. Therefore, I have brought him out before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after examination has taken place, I might have something to write. For it seems unreasonable to me to send a prisoner and not specify the charges against him. Unreasonable, it's crazy. You're going to send a man to Augustus, and you're going to charge him with a crime, and you don't even know what the crime is? You know what Festus wants? Festus wants Agrippa to get him off the hook. He wants him to find something wrong. And so now Agrippa's going to get his turn. In chapter 26, Paul speaks in his own defense. And why not? He's the best one qualified to speak. And I want you to notice in verse number 2 what he says to Agrippa. I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because today I shall answer for myself before you concerning all the things of which I am accused of by the Jews, especially because you are an expert in all customs and questions which have to do with the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to hear me patiently. The Agrippas were well aware of the Jews. The family of Agrippa well understood the ways of the Jews. And so he's happy to stand before Agrippa. And as he stands before Agrippa, he tells of his persecution again, and he recounts his conversion. And he says in verse number 26 and 19 through 23, when he had the heavenly vision, what's he talking about? He's talking about on the road to Damascus. When I had the heavenly vision, I did not rebel against it, but I went ahead and I followed through with what I was told to do. In verse 23, that the Christ would suffer, that he would be the first to rise from the dead, and would proclaim light to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. Now, Festus thinks Paul's lost his mind. Look at the next verse. Festus says, and thus his defense, Festus said with a loud voice, Paul, you're beside yourself. Much learning is driving you mad. What was Paul's reply to that? Look at verse 25. But he said, I am not mad, most noble Festus, but I speak the words of truth and reason. You know what that means? That means he spoke what was honorable. You could reason through with it. You could understand it if you wanted to. He's not mad. You know what he does? Here's a man who's before a king that can determine if he'll live or die. He's going to have to send him to Rome because he's appealed to Augustus. What does Paul do? Does he take the low way out? Does he take the way that kind of go quietly? No, he doesn't do that, does he? Look at verse 26. For the king knows of all the things I speak freely, knows these things. I am convinced that none of these things escape your attention, since these things were not done in a corner. What does he mean, not done in a corner? He means that he did his work openly. He did it for all men to see and to hear. He didn't hide behind anything. He didn't do it in private. He did it publicly, and Agrippa was well aware of it. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you do believe. But brethren, that's a strong affirmation. He tells King Agrippa, I know you believe the prophets. What's Agrippa's reply? Then Agrippa said, "You almost persuade me to become a Christian." Paul said, "I would to God that not only you, but that all who hear me today might become both altogether and altogether such as I am, except for these chains." What did he mean? Altogether like I am, except for the chains. Except being bound, he wished they were all obedient and committed to God like he was. Agrippa is almost persuaded. But you know what is Agrippa's verdict about the man? Look at verse 30. What does he think about Paul? "And when he said these things, the king stood up, as well as the governor and Bernice and all those who sat with him. And when he had gone aside, they talked among themselves, saying, 'This man has done nothing worth deserving of death or of chains.' Then Agrippa said to Felix, 'This man might have been set free had he not appealed to Caesar.'" You know, when you read that last verse, it kind of does it make you kind of think that maybe Paul outthought himself here? Because he could have got out. But he didn't want out. He wanted to go to Rome. Because that's what God wanted him. Remember what God told him? "You will be my witness in Rome." But you know, I want you to notice, he stood before the garrison commander. He stood before the council. He stood before Festus. He stood before Felix. He stood before Agrippa. And none of them were able to prove their case against the man. None of them. But yet he's still going to Rome. Now that's going to be a nice little trip, isn't it? Nope. The journey to Rome is anything but nice. The journey to Rome, Paul is delivered to the centurion as a prisoner. Remember, he is a prisoner. He is in chains. And he's delivered to the ship to make the trip to Rome as a prisoner. The winds are contrary, and he's placed on an Alexandrian ship in verses 4 through 6. Now, Paul has some advice. Look at verse 9 of chapter 27. "Now when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised him, saying, 'Men, I perceive that this voyage will end in disaster and much loss, not only of cargo and ship, but also of life. Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul.'" Why should he listen to Paul? Paul's a prisoner. Why listen to him? He doesn't know anything. And so, he's not convinced, and he determines that he will go on and proceed further. Now, in chapter 27, beginning in verse 12, "Then they head to Phoenix, and they're heading there so they can winter." You know, it's not like getting in a plane or going there and being there in 6 or 7 hours. We're talking about the time before planes and trains and automobiles. We're talking about the time where it took a long time to get from place to place. And any great distance had to be covered by a ship. And a ship to go over a body of water, that was a dangerous journey. And so now they're going to harbor for the winter, or are they? Now, there is a wind, beginning in verse 14, in chapter 27, a temperate headwind that arose, and it would not, and it says, "We let her drive." And what that means is they let the wind have her way with her. And the wind just drove the ship. Now, the skiff was secured and the ship lightened. In verse number 16, "We secured the skiff with difficulty. When they had taken it on board, they used the cables to undergird the ship, fearing lest they should run aground on citrus sands. They struck sail, and so we were driven. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. And on the third day, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands." Now, things are not going well. It's getting more and more difficult. They get rid of all the ship on the tackle. It says in verse 20, they saw neither sun nor stars for many days. You know what that means? They didn't know where they were at. They couldn't navigate. They didn't have one of those GPSs. They navigated by the sun and the stars. And now they can't see, so you know what they're doing? They're out there going blindly. And the Bible says, in verse number 21, that Paul said, after long abstinence from food, Paul stood in the midst of them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not sailed from Crete and incurred your disaster and loss. But now I urge you to take heart. There will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship." Now, how in the world did he know that? No sun, no stars. They've gotten rid of the tackle. They're being driven by the wind. They've got no idea where they're at. They don't know where they're going. This wind is just driving them all over the water. But Paul says, "You're not going to lose your life. For there stood by me this night an angel from God, whom I belong and to whom I serve. For there stood by me this night the angel saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all those who sail with you.'" God hadn't forgotten what he said. He said, "Paul, you're still going to Rome, and I'm going to let you take all the people that are with you." Now, that must have been good news for Paul, but was it good news for the crew? And in verse 26, they must run aground. However, we must run aground on a certain island. If this is going to come to pass, we're going to have to run the ship aground. They took soundings and dropped the anchors, and they're called fathoms. And what they wanted to do is see how close they were getting to land, and so they wouldn't be destroyed as they got closer to land. It might hit a reef. And Paul warned that they must stay on the ship. Now, I found this very interesting in verse 30. "For the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship when they had let down the skiff into the sea under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow." What he means is a lifeboat. They put them in to get rid of them, and they were thinking, "Why don't we get off this thing? Things don't look good. We can't see the sun. We can't see the stars. We don't know where we're going. We're going to run aground. Let's get in the lifeboat." What did he say? Look at verse 31. Paul said to the centurion and the soldier, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." You know what this is? This is a divine condition. If you want your life spared, you're going to have to stay on the ship. You know what they had to do? They had to make a decision. Did they believe Paul, or would they trust themselves? Look at the next verse. "Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff, and they let it fall off." You know what has happened? Paul has won their trust. You know why? Because he's not afraid. He trusts God. And they can see it. Why would mariners who know the seas, know the waters, been on many, many trips, they've been on troubled water before, why would they listen to this man, Paul? They must have saw something. 2 weeks without food. I can't fathom this, but 2 weeks without food. The wheat and the cargo are thrown in the sea. You know what? That's the last thing to go. The cargo is the last thing to go, and the only thing that is left are the lives that are aboard the ship. In chapter 27, they determined to kill the prisoners, lest they escape when the ship is shipwrecked. But who steps in? Look at verse 42. "And the soldiers planned to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land, and the rest on some of the boards and some on the parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped to safety to the land. Why should this centurion be concerned about Paul? Why not kill him? He's just a prisoner. I think he believed Paul. And I think he knew that as long as he did what Paul said, things would go well for them. And you know what? They did. When it was all done and the ship was wrecked, 276 men, lives were spared because they followed the instructions of Paul. He's still not in Rome. Now he's shipwrecked. Now he doesn't even have a ship. He's on the Isle of Malta. How's he going to get to Rome? He's still a good piece from Rome. The natives were kind and they make a fire. And as they're making a fire, Paul is getting wood. And as he does, a viper who's close to the heat comes out and latches on to his hand. You know, I could just picture this. And here are all these natives watching Paul. And you know what they thought? This man's a murderer. And not wanting him to escape his punishment, God is now taking his life because he won't escape punishment. But you know what? The longer they looked, nothing happened. So what must he be? He must be a god. He must be a god. It just shows you the superstition of the people. They were ignorant religiously. And so when Paul didn't die, they just believed that he was a god. But you know, the leading citizen of that island is entertained for 3 days, beginning in verse 7. And the region there was an estate of the leading citizen, the island whose name was Parabas, who received us and entertained us with courtesy for 3 days. And it says in the next verse that it happened that the father was sick. What does Paul do? He heals him. If they didn't think he was a god now, not then when he was bit by the viper, they definitely believe that he's a god now. And you know what he does? They bring all the people that are sick. Now, if you were on this island, wouldn't you do that? Here's a man that came off shipwrecked on your island. He heals your father. They bring everybody that's sick, and Paul heals them all. Now, was that just done for their benefit? No, that was a courtesy that Paul was extending them because they kept them alive and kept them warm and were courtesy to them. But you know what? There's another reason why Paul did that. What's going to happen when they leave? What's going to happen when they leave? And when they left, they supplied them with everything they needed. Why? Because they respected Paul. Lo and behold, Paul arrives at Puteoli and stays with the brethren in verse chapter 28, 11 through 14. And he's met by the brethren at the Appian Forum. And he arrives in Rome, and Paul's allowed to dwell in a house with a guard. And he's allowed to live there for 2 years with none forbidding to come to him and to see him. What did God tell Paul when he was in prison that night? Be of good cheer. As you have been my witness in Jerusalem, you shall also be my witness in Rome. Where is he at? In Rome. He has now made the journey, and he is now in Rome. Now, Paul calls the Jewish leaders together, and they have not heard the things that men have said about Paul, but when he talks to them, some believe and some don't. They wanted to hear about the sect, and so he tells them about the sect, and what he's talking about is Christians. And Paul lodged there and taught the gospel for 2 full years, and the prophecy was fulfilled in them, beginning in verse 25 through 27. Go to this people and say, hearing you will hear and you shall not understand. Seeing you will see and you will not perceive. For the hearts of this people have grown dull, their ears are hard of hearing, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes, hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts, and turn so that I can heal them. Therefore, let it be known to you that salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles, for they will hear it. And then they had a dispute, the Jews. Now, that surprised any of you? That the Jews had a dispute about that? Salvation now goes to the Gentile. Who is Paul a vessel for? The Gentile. Now, concluding thoughts. Paul was told that he would go to Rome. God made no direct intervention in any of the things that took place from the time he went to Jerusalem to the time that he landed in Rome. God did nothing miraculously to allow Paul to live, except the snake. But you know what? Read Mark 16, verse 20. Remember the things that Paul said would follow those that believe? If they drank any deadly thing, if they were bedden, they would not die. That was promised by God, was it not? Paul was one of those apostles. And so nothing miraculously except that one event that was a promise by God for the apostles that God would send. The choices were made by the man and they were made at Paul. But ladies and gentlemen, every decision led Paul to where God wanted him to be. Do you not see that? Did all those things just happen? That's the longest string of coincidences I've ever seen if it just happened. The nephew overheard the plot. The centurion was willing to save Paul and believe the nephew and send him by night. Felix, Agrippa, Festus, any of them could have condemned him to death, but they were honest enough to know that there were no charges proved. And when he demonstrated his faithfulness to God in the midst of a terrible storm and in the midst of certain death for the crew and for everyone on that ship, Paul didn't flinch. He was where God wanted him to be. Ladies and gentlemen, the prisoner of Rome, but still a preacher of the gospel. He was there for 2 years. And you know what he did while he was there for 2 years? He had a rented house, and everyone came to that rented house, and he preached the gospel to those in Rome. And when we read the letter written to the church of Rome, it says that he even converted some of the household of Caesar. You know why? Because this man believed in the providence of God. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no clearer picture of how God works behind the scenes of his faithful servant. When we do the things that God has asked us to do,